Why do we drink what we do? Why do some drinks become classics while others languish at the back of the drinks cabinet?
Is it just because we prefer those drinks, or are there underlying economic, social, or technological trends that shape our choices?
And that's what we're going to explore on A Question of Drinks.
Join us as we explore the hidden side of the drinks cabinet, the decisions, reversals, and underlying forces that shape the beverage market. I'm Luli Halstead.
And I'm Felicity Carter. And together we host A Question of Drinks. Luli, it's great to see you. And you are looking so fresh when you just came off the plane from Bordeaux.
Oh, thank you for the compliment. I have just come off a plane, and we could say from the spiritual home of wine. So how are you? Looking beautiful, of course, Felicity.
Well, I'm packing. I'm getting ready to leave for Bordeaux. They're having the Great Wine Capitals Wine Tourism Conference next week, and you should have stayed on. We could meet up.
Oh, that would have been so good. Imagine what fun we would have had in Bordeaux over the weekend. But at least we can lead nicely off being in Bordeaux, both of us, which is to say one of the most traditional, we could say, wine-growing regions in the world, as we have a question all about innovation in wine today. It's like we planned it, Felicity, as if we are consummate professionals.
Well, we can make it look like we did. Yes. Okay, so innovation's a huge topic. Go ahead.
It is. And it's from a questioner this week called Patrick, who is actually based in my hometown of London.
Oh, is he? Now, this Patrick wouldn't happen to be a relative or a neighbour by any chance?
You're so cynical, Felicity. Well, even if he was, his question would still be legitimate and still be welcome. So there. So anyway, Patrick asks, why don't I see more innovation in wine? Nothing seems to have changed really since I started drinking wine 30 years ago. Yet I see so much innovation in spirits and beers, for example. Why is this? So I'm going to start by saying I agree with Patrick, Felicity. Innovation is possibly the most overused word in wine. And usually what people mean is we did a new label.
Now, I'm going to agree with you on that. I agree absolutely that the word is used and abused. However, mm-hmm. I'm going to vigorously disagree with the premise of Patrick's question.
Oh.
I think wine is extremely innovative. In fact, as much as spirits, if not more so.
Okay. So Felicity, we're going to get controversial right from the start, because I think most people would agree with Patrick that the wine shelves look a lot like they did decades ago. So here's a plan. Shall we set this up as kind of defense and prosecution then, Felicity? I'm definitely going to be on the side of Patrick and defend that wine is not an innovative category, and you can take the role of prosecutor, putting the case forward for there's lots of innovation in wine, seeing as that's what you seem to think.
I think being the prosecutor suits me very well, actually. I like a good argument. Bring it on.
Oh, okay, here we go. So starting with your opening arguments then, Felicity, in true courtroom style, what's your case for there being lots of innovation in wine? Go.
Well, I would say just in the last 30 years, there have been enormous changes, and I'll just name a few off the top of my head. Okay, the use of lightweight glass, cans, new strains of yeast, new forms of trellising, new varieties, the rise of new wines, rosé, orange and natural wine, and even the introduction of hybrid grapes. The field is enormous. I could list about 10 more if you wanted.
I don't want you to, because that's fair, but, and I think this is a really important bit, most of that happened backstage. So what Patrick is saying is the front of house hasn't changed in the wine aisle, effectively what he sees as a consumer.
Well, it has changed. It's just the changes aren't visible to the naked eye. Now, that's not the same as saying there's been no innovation. But what's interesting here is that because the emphasis in wine is on heritage and tradition, people make huge changes while going out of their way to insist that the final product is traditional and unchanging.
Okay, I can see that this is going to be one of our liveliest episodes, Felicity. So we're going to have to disagree on quite a lot.
Well, before we do that, why don't we start by defining what innovation is and take it from there. So, Luli, what does the academic literature have to say?
Ah, okay. Thank you for asking. So, academic hat on, yes. Let's define what innovation actually is, and particularly, and I think this is the real crux of this, particularly in relation to NPD, so new product development, which is probably where Patrick is coming from. So as I said earlier in my opening statement, I feel that innovation can be one of the most overused words in business and possibly the most misunderstood, in wine.
Okay, so I'm with you so far. I completely agree. Quite often what people call innovation just means tweaking something that's been going on for a long time.
Yeah. So let me bring in some evidence, Felicity. See, I'm rolling with the whole courtroom premise. We just need wigs and gowns now. Anyway, so this morning I saw a post on LinkedIn from Treasury Wine Estates. And it said, last weekend, so I quote from the article, last weekend we took our newest innovation, sorbet, on the road across New South Wales, delivering a fresh burst of flavour across the state.
So that's irritating me already.
Okay, you said it, not me. I'm just quoting.
LinkedIn so, copy. All right. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So they, well, again, you said it, not me. They continue with... by stating, with just 9% ABV and 80 calories per serve, sorbet is all about easy social sipping. From hero raspberry rosé to zesty lemon prosecco, mango Sauvignon Blanc, and maybe your favourite, Felicity, wildberry Shiraz. Each varietal, let me finish. Each varietal reimagines a classic with a juicy, refreshing twist.
Okay. Apart from the fact this is ever so slightly nauseating copy, I agree. This is not innovation. This is a continuation of a very, very old trend of adding fruit to wine, like modern day sangria.
Exactly. So now sorbet is a fruit infused wine, and I have to apologise if it isn't. I've kind of tried to research it and find out that it is actually fruit infused, because that's how the press release read, and I couldn't find any more detailed information. So it's assuming I have understood the product correctly, this is a textbook case of new product development, not innovation. So lower ABV wine plus fruit flavour is not new.
Well, let's not forget your very own Tinto di Verano that you made recently, which had a beautiful picture made of it.
It did. And you know, Felicity, as a result of people hearing me talk about that on this podcast, I've actually been contacted by some people to ask for my recipe, which was a little bit awkward because I kind of made it up and I've got no idea what the quantities were. Anyway, a retirement project for me, Felicity, we could build our own brand, although I'm not sure I've got credibility requirements for that.
Lily, I can guarantee you that if you had me on board, the project would tank. So I think this is, you know, not because I don't want to be part of it, but because my mixing skills suck. But anyway, back to sorbet.
Yeah, so it belongs to a long line of people who've been working with fruit. So let's go back to 1998. So in the US, we have Arbor Mist. You know, they quote it as saying great tasting with wine with a splash of fruit. Peach, raspberry, mango, and those are all around 6 or 7% ABV. Wind the clock forward to the 2010s. So we've got big brands like Gallo Spritz, Barefoot Refresh, Blossom Hill Fruit Bloom, and Echo Falls Fruit Fusion. So it's basically the same model wine plus fruit flavour. Plus lower alcohol.
Oh, yeah. I remember there was a craze about this type of wine in France. Mm. So Castel was making fruit-infused wines that absolutely flew off the shelves. And we had to do tastings of them.
Lucky you. I remember
bottles and bottles. And anyway, for my money, for what it's worth, the lime flavours worked the best.
I'm kind of with you on that, although I am a bit partial to the mango skews. Anyway. So, yes, this is a case of what Treasury is doing with sorbet, which is we could call it basically category echo, not category shift. So innovation, by its definition, changes behaviour. MPD changes packaging. So if you can slot a new product neatly into the old one on the shelf, it's not innovation, it's inventory.
Well, hang on a second. See, I'm beginning to disagree already. I can feel my...
Your hackles
cheeks
going up.
Red. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. There are lots of innovations that have been groundbreaking that didn't change consumer behaviour.
Okay. I can't wait to hear, but I'm going to challenge you back. Okay. So because the definition, I believe, of innovation is that it fundamentally changes behaviour. But I'll come on to that in shortly. So what's your evidence, Ms. Carter?
Well, I think the most famous one that comes to the top of my head is the one from Outside Wine, which is the Betamax video cassette introduced by Sony in 1976. Now, it lost the market to VHS, even though it was better.
And it also ages you, but let's move on from that. So, yes.
I read about it.
Oh, yeah, I believe you. So, yeah. But VHS is the one that changed the behaviour. So kind of that's my point.
Well, no, because although Betamax didn't win the market, the technological innovations that it introduced became widely used and copied. It led to the Betacam, for example, which for a long time was the professional standard for broadcast.
Again, is that a good analogy? I'm kind of thinking, is there something in wine that ended up changing the drinking experience, even though it was initially rejected?
Yes. there was.
Okay, go.
And it comes from, well, I was going to say Australia, but actually it comes from France. It was the humble screw cork. It was first introduced by the New Zealanders and then by the Clare Valley in Australia. It solved the problem of cork taint. But it was absolutely rejected by most markets for years because it signalled cheap and cheerful.
But I think we should note that screw caps, which have been widely used in other categories, so including spirits, olive oil, et cetera, long before it was adopted in wine. So is that an example of innovation or just adoption of an existing innovation?
Well, I'm going to call it innovation because of the amount of research it took to adapt it to wine. So the screw cap closure used in wine is fundamentally different than one used from, say, olive oil or spirits. So the existing liners that were around could ruin wine aromas and flavours. So, you know, there was this huge amount of liner research that took place in France and so on. So maybe the innovation is actually the liner, okay? So the liner is an innovation.
Okay. I'll give you that one. Okay, yeah. I'll give you that the liner was an innovation as opposed to the screw cap itself. And I guess the bag in box then we could think about being as another innovation that took a long time to take off because it broke so thoroughly with the tradition that is wine.
Well, so, it depends on the market. In the initial market in Australia, it was very quickly adopted.
Yeah, I remember you called it on a previous episode. There was some fantastic Australian terminology or references to bag in box of handbags or something.
There's some, but they're not for a polite podcast like this. But anyway, so yes. Carry on.
So can I now put my case forward for a definition of innovation? Because I think we need one.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Okay, good. So if we talk about the theory of innovation, we can kind of look at it through three lenses. So destruction, disruption, and diffusion.
Oh, alliteration. Look at you.
I know. I'm quite proud of that. It's another one of my frameworks. Well, quasi-frameworks. Anyway, so the first lens is all about destruction. So this one was first coined by the Austrian economist Joseph Schumpeter, writing in the 1930s, who suggested the phrase creative destruction. So basically, this is the idea that true innovation doesn't improve an old model. It replaces it. So it effectively destroys one equilibrium to create another.
I've got an example. I've got one.
Okay. You'd have to put your hand up.
Oh, sorry. I'll put my hand down. Okay, listeners, pretend I didn't put my hand up. All right, so the answer is New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc.
Oh, you're going to have to put a really strong case forward for this one, Felicity. Sauvignon Blanc was already a known variety in the Loire Valley, probably grown for more than 400 years prior to this, so known for its ability to make both dry and sweet wine. So what's your case for this being innovative then?
Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc is fundamentally different. Okay, so going back to the 1980s, before the Kiwis started exporting, the market for white wine was pretty much soft oat styles of wine. So the New Zealanders took a completely different approach to winemaking that had never been done before. They did early harvesting, they fermented in stainless steel, and they used special yeast strains to preserve aromas called thiols. So the wines weren't just highly aromatic, they completely redefined the concept of freshness in wine. They fundamentally reset the market.
Okay, so I'm not convinced by your evidence there, Felicity. I'm thinking something like Pete Baldepino. So do we say that that's not a fresh style of wine or Bordeaux Blanc using Sauvignon Blanc or Loire?
Okay, but what did they do that was different about making it?
New Zealanders?
What the New Zealanders did was completely groundbreaking. And so what people have done after them is this have adopted the techniques, but they didn't come up with them, but the New Zealanders did.
Okay. I'm going to park that one slightly. Can we jump in? Yeah, because I'm going somewhere with this. Can we jump in, jump a rather considerable 70 years on from Schumpeter's work? Okay. So we're now in 2005 and the OECD's Oslo manual. So effectively, this is the official handbook on measuring innovation. That's sort of like the global standard. Let's call it that. So this gives us what is perhaps a very beige, but nonetheless really useful definition.
Yes, it's pretty much the same as if a bunch of EU Brussels bureaucrats had come up with the definition. It states the innovation is, quote, the implementation of a new or significantly improved product, process, marketing method or organisational method.
Yes.
You can imagine the committee meeting, everyone was arguing for their thing. I want to put the organisational method. All right.
Yes. Yeah, I know. It's a page and it's not a very, it doesn't, not the most memorable, but I think it's really good in terms of what how it actually defines innovation. So to challenge you again, this definition means, therefore, that innovation can't be an incremental improvement. And
oh, my hand up. I've got another one.
Okay, go on then.
It's one that we've actually covered on this podcast in our Prosecco episode. So the Charmat method of making sparkling wine.
Where the secondary
fermentation takes place in a stainless steel tank, not a bottle, fulfills every one of the OECD criteria.
Okay, so you might have a point there, Felicity. So a stronger example, yes, granted. You're persuading me perhaps a little bit on this one. So I do concede a little bit, but continue. The floor's yours. Go.
So what the Charmat did was it created a very different type of sparkling wine. And this is what allowed Prosecco to rise as a category. So Prosecco is actually, I've tasted this, I'm not just making this up. It either makes a really dull, dry wine, or it makes, if it's made in the champagne style, it makes a very unbalanced wine that's very difficult to drink. So what the Charmat method did was it democratized sparkling wine and it made it into an everyday product.
So first up, Felicity, no one would ever accuse you of making stuff up. So I'm sure you have tried it. And second, your argument, I grant it, is a little bit more persuasive. So let's take lens number two on innovation then, because you kind of persuaded me a little bit, but bear with again. So I'm interested to hear your prosecution evidence on this one. So the second one is all about disruptive innovation, and this is primarily about expanding the market, so expanding who buys.
All right, you're going to have to explain this one a bit more.
Okay, so thank you. So this stems from the 1997 work, which is called The Inventor's Dilemma. And this was from the wonderful Harvard professor, Clayton Christensen, who introduced the idea of disruptive innovation. So basically that products that start simple or cheap are often dismissed, particularly by the incumbents, but end up kind of creating whole new markets.
Do you know how I know about this work?
Okay, go. Why? How?
Because every wannabe thought leader on LinkedIn talks about the innovator's dilemma. I've read the whole book without actually reading the whole book.
Well, anyway, lucky you. That's actually a really good book. He's amazing.
Maybe I should actually read it rather than reading the LinkedIn version.
Amazing thinker. I've got lots of time for him.
Okay, so I have the perfect example of this, and it's Yellowtail.
Okay. Let's see where we're going with this. So I've cited this before. So when Wine Intelligence, now IWSR, surveys regular wine drinkers in many markets globally, Yellowtail consistently comes out as the most loved wine brand in the world from a regular wine drinker consumer point of view. And that's based on a combination of metrics that include kind of awareness, conversion, recommendation, and affinity. And full disclosure, as I've said before, I have consulted to Casella, the family that makes Yellowtail, for more than 15 years. So just want to put out full disclosure there.
All right. So it was launched in the US market around the turn of the century, and it was ultra accessible. It was low price. It was soft. It wasn't tannic. And they added a bit of residual sugar and it became a juggernaut. But here's what's interesting. Until it arrived, the incumbents in the market hadn't taken that low price point end of the market seriously. Mm. And so you could only buy really sort of poor products. And so suddenly there was this great tasting product that people could buy for not very much money and there was no risk.
Okay. So as much as I'm a fan of Yellowtail and always will be, I'm going to disagree with you slightly again, Felicity, or slightly, if that's me being my polite English. I'm going to disagree with you, Felicity. So for me, this was more about a case of brilliant branding and positioning combined with great product attributes rather than innovation in the purest OECD definition of the word innovation.
But it introduced people to wine, Luli. So it did that. It took market share from beer and soft drink drinkers. It pretty much started a whole new category. It laid the path for later blockbusters like Barefoot.
Well, again, not quite true, Felicity. So let me introduce some data evidence. So
if you
look at the data, so Yellowtail's success in terms of sales comes from selling to existing wine drinkers who switched to Yellowtail because it's a great product, great branding, great DBAs, distinctive brand assets, product cues, and more importantly, met the existing consumer's need. So we could say this is a better, they did it in a better way than the incumbent than the incumbents did. So it wasn't necessarily about bringing new drinkers into the category. It was more about meeting the needs better of the existing players. But I just want to go back to something you mentioned about eating the high-ended players alive earlier. What did you mean by that?
Well, this is the downside of Yellowtail. So it came to define what Australia was in the all-important US market. And because it was cheap and mass market, it actually helped to bring down the entire Australian category. Which it still hasn't recovered from that.
Strong statement again, Felicity, but I would say that it was Yellowtail's many imitators that positioned the category there, potentially more than Yellowtail.
I will agree with that. But the eating the, you know, the other end of the market, that does fit Christensen's definition.
Yes. So to expand on that, Christensen's point is that true innovation expands who buys, not just what they buy. So here's a quick litmus test that I think is a really helpful way of kind of thinking about innovation and probably the best way to think of it, particularly versus NPD. So if your new product persuades existing customers to buy one more bottle or to buy a bottle, that's NPD. If it brings new people into the category or changes how they use it, then that's innovation.
Well, I think it did bring new people into the category. Over the years, many, many retailers in the US have told me this.
Okay, so in my polite English way, I'm going to politely disagree with you again,
We're in court,
Felicity.
Lily. You can just go for the jugular.
You're wrong, Felicity. It is a convenient trade myth that has perpetuated over time that Yellowtail succeeded by only bringing new drinkers into the category.
I didn't say it only brought new drinkers. I said it brought new drinkers.
Some new drinkers. So if you actually look at the data from real consumers who did buy it going back to 15 years and continue to buy it, you'll see that the majority of them were already wine drinkers. And I've got a second piece of evidence. So you can't sell 10 million cases of wine a year in a market like the US by bringing in new drinkers only. That's mathematically...
I didn't say they were only new drinkers.
I know, but I'm dubbing court, Felicity. Let me roll with it. You can't interrupt. Sorry. Mathematically impossible. So it has to appeal to current heavy and light buyers as well. Otherwise, you simply can't sustain those volumes. So the primary driver of Yellowtail was to switch existing, not to bring in new, which means it doesn't come under the definition of innovation. But perhaps we can agree that behavioural change is a real measure of innovation then?
No, I'm going to disagree. I completely disagree. You're flat wrong, Lily.
Okay, go. You're on full throttle, Felicity. Lack of sleep or extra caffeine involved?
Both actually, both. Can you tell? Okay, yes. So let's go back to the screw cap example.
Okay,
so
yeah.
They did this research, which was groundbreaking, to solve oxidation and taint. And it was incredibly innovative. But the screw cap was rejected by a lot of the market for years. So when people embraced it later, it was proof that the innovation had taken hold, not that innovation had happened.
Exactly. So you're kind of making my point for me there, Felicity. The point was it was adopted. It just happened to take a while.
I think there's some tricky wordplay going on in here. For the third lens, all right. So this word diffusion, I think, is what we're talking about here. So there's a guy called Everett Rogers, an American sociologist, who wrote a book called The Diffusion of Innovations, which explains how ideas spread.
Absolutely. So he states in that innovations move through the five groups. So we start with innovators, funnily enough, early adopters, early majority, late majority, and laggards. But incremental NPD rarely crosses that kind of whole chasm. So it never feels new or valuable enough to move beyond the kind of the early fringe.
Oh, I completely agree. And I do agree with what we said earlier, which is that many people think, you know, tweaking around the margins is innovation.
Yeah, exactly. So in mature categories, that clutter actually speeds decline. So too many SKUs, no real excitement, and effectively consumers switching off.
Well, I think this is probably what happened with Chardonnay in the late 1990s. So there was this corrective shock of Sauvignon Blanc, and maybe in the States, Pinot Grigio.
Yeah.
And so in a response almost, Chardonnay got bigger, bolder, oakier, and it got to the point that shelves had nothing on them but these big buttery Chardonnays until the wine critics actually got really sick of them. Some of the British journalists started a movement called Anything But Chardonnay, and that tanked the category.
Yeah, except for the fact that buttery Chardonnays remain and still do hugely popular, and particularly with me. So they've never stopped being bestsellers. And so although elite wine opinion may have fallen out of love with them, actually wine drinkers haven't. And we can see that again in the data.
Well, is it that they haven't fallen out with them? Or I mean, the point I'm trying to make is that the shelves at one point were just full of it, and people did just get sick of the sheer number of it.
Yeah.
And so a
yeah.
lot of that did get kicked out of the market. But I take I do take your point, and you're absolutely right. I mean, you are, in fact, the global ambassador for buttery oak.
Okay, I know. Do you know, rather embarrassingly, one of the clients I was working with in Bordeaux yesterday apologised to me when he served me their Chateau's Bordeaux Blanc, because he listens to our podcast and hears me banging on about my love of Chardonnay.
Client, whoever you are, send it to me. You're wasting your time sending it to Luli. Okay, so getting us back on track, this actually brings me to an important... Oh, I'll give you my address. This actually brings me to an important point about how innovation works in wine. I think there's a lot of innovation happening, particularly at the commercial ends, you know, like the blue wine we talked about in a recent episode, but it passed unnoticed by commenters because they don't consider it real wine.
Except, Felicity, that whilst blue wine might well be innovative, which we talked about in our last episode, one before, can't remember. Anyway, it didn't fundamentally shift consumer behaviour, basically because nobody bought it. So it doesn't meet my threshold of innovation. So you can launch a new different product, but it isn't innovation if people don't go and buy it.
See, I'm going to hammer home that this is something I fundamentally disagree with, that it has to shift consumer behaviour to be innovative. I mean, that would be like saying that important scientific breakthrough doesn't get classed as innovation until doctors start prescribing it.
Okay, so we're in danger of potentially getting caught up in semantics here and boring
our listeners. Or in danger of sidestepping my excellent argument.
No, because I have a rebuttal, Felicity. Just you wait, and I've got a really good one coming here. Okay, so if we haven't bored ourselves or our listeners yet, let me have one more stab at this defining innovation, if you will, my lord. See, that's the court bit. Anyway, so to loop back to the OECD boring beige but very good useful definition, it's the implementation of a new or significantly improved product, process, marketing method or organisational method. So if we buy into this definition, that means that an idea doesn't count as innovation until it's actually applied, not just imagined or, to your point, invented. So the most important part of my case for the defence of Patrick's question, invention is the idea, innovation is the idea in use.
Well, fair enough. But I will just point out to end this that means penicillin wasn't an innovation until somebody packaged it.
That's my point exactly, Felicity. It was an investigation and then an invention, and then it became an innovation when somebody packaged it and sold it, because fundamentally then it changed behaviour. Mm. So... Okay. I told you I was going to go somewhere with this one.
So they said that Alexander Fleming, sorry, that wasn't really an innovation.
It was an invention. It was an invention. The innovation bit is when it's adopted by the marketplace. So ploughing on, do you remember us talking about the concept of sacralization on our last episode?
I do remember, because that's the reason people can't throw out their sediment-filled bottles of spirits, because they imbue them with special meaning.
And that included you, because you confessed that on our last episode.
Yes.
You did. And so this process really explains the phenomena of what's considered, I guess, real wine or not. So you will indulge me if I go back into the work of Pierre Bourdieu, always try to pronounce that correctly, always fail, and his 1979 book Distinction, which I kind of seem to reference on most episodes.
Do you think we should have a giveaway to listeners? It's really our Christmas giveaway. Yes. Read Bourdieu, this so you'll understand all of 2026's episodes.
Yes. Can we do a brief detour onto him?
Yes, please do.
Because understanding him, I think, explains quite a lot about the context of his ideas.
And also we like gossip.
We do. Okay, so he wasn't some Parisian salon intellectual. So he grew up in a working class family in rural southwest France, son of a postal worker, but he never lost that sort of outsider edge. So people who knew him described him as brilliant, impatient, completely allergic to pretension. He could apparently dismantle a sloppy argument in seconds, usually without raising his voice.
Thank God he's not on the podcast.
I know. I'm just thinking, remind me of someone. And apparently he didn't do charm. Oh, no.
Oh, I
see,
the perfect person. Yes, all right. So he's the perfect person to talk about status. So the one thing I remember about him is his idea of symbolic capital, that's prestige that's earned by knowing the rules of the game.
Exactly. And his genius was showing that these rules feel invisible. So they don't need to be taught. Effectively, they're absorbed around us.
And that makes wine perfect for this. You know, nobody ever told us that it was smart and sophisticated. We just knew it.
We did. Yeah, we did, Felicity. And that explains why wine has this sort of aura of being permanently historical. So never changing, never evolving, and definitely not the subject, therefore, of ordinary market forces.
Yeah, and I think this is really, really interesting. So producers don't think of themselves as innovators because then they would have to admit that wine is a product like any other that can change and evolve. And that is also, I guess, why people get incredibly angry about innovations like wine fermented in bourbon barrels.
Yeah, well, that's a really good example. So wines that go into barrels that once had spirits, you know, tequila or whiskey, bourbon, whatever, in them end up typically much richer with stronger sort of smoky notes. They're also typically made to be much more alcoholic than your typical red wine. So weighing in at kind of super heavy weight, 18% ABV.
Yeah, so I actually tried to find out who started the trend. And I read a Vine Pair article that said Fetzer Vineyard in the US had used bourbon barrels in the 1980s because they couldn't afford French oak.
Yeah, well, they debuted a wine called A Thousand Stories. Do you remember that? In 2014. And the category really took off after that. So I remember, I'm sure you do, walking around Provine and everyone kind of had one and they were really flying. The funny thing is, though, you'd think the story of reusing barrels would resonate with the wine trade with its kind of emphasis on sustainability,
You would, but you don't. Instead, you get articles like the 2019 Vine Pair piece that was called, and check this, bourbon barreled aged wine isn't real wine, and that's okay, which of course means it's not okay. It's not real wine.
Why? What did it say?
Let me read you the article.
Quote,
at this point, those who look down on the category might argue that these aren't real wines. They'd be right. Everything from the taste to serving vessel to packaging to promotion moves these beverages as far from that stuffy thing people like to call wine as possible. And so it's not wine, at least not in a traditional or recognisable way. The thing is, that's exactly why everyone making and buying it likes it so much. They're referring to the smokiness when they say that.
But to be honest, that sounds like they talk about wine to me.
Well, this is what's really, really interesting. So why is that not a wine, but something like port is allowed to be a wine?
Good
and that
point.
Was a red wine that was deliberately fortified with brandy during fermentation to preserve the sweetness. Now, what's really interesting is I had a look at this and it turned out that port was considered a radical innovation at the time. And traditionalists hated it. The Spectator in the 18th century complained that Portuguese wines were, quote, spoiled with brandy.
Okay, so that brings us back to when someone does innovate then, adoption is often really quite slow or painfully slow. So your example, you were talking about screw caps earlier, could be a case in point.
Yeah, and then sometimes you get companies who try and almost impose innovation on the wine industry, particularly through telling people this is the new fancy glassware that we've done the research and you have to use it.
Yes.
And it often backfires. People don't mind a new bowl shape, for example, but they still want it on a stem.
So there's another factor at play here when it comes to innovation in wine, I guess, and that's really centred around ritual.
Oh, yeah, good. Yes, I would agree with that. Yes. And this is the earlier point about, you know, wine as performance. So you pour it from a 750ml bottle into stem glasses, you serve it at the right temperature, you know, it's often the right part of the table in the right company and so on.
Yeah, so effectively every gesture's reinforcing that isn't just a drink, it's kind of almost moving into the realms of being a ceremony.
Yeah, and the funny part is that all of this stuff, the 250ml bottle and a 12-bottle case, they're not part of drinking tradition at all. They were part of a logistics reason, but they've become part of the mythology.
I love your history interjects. I'm just going to correct you on one thing there because you said 250ml bottles, Felicity. 750.
Oh, 750. Oh, God, did I?
Okay, 750.
So, too much caffeine. Not enough caffeine. Okay, so basically we've got them because they come from shipping and glassblowing efficiency. So 750ml was just the average capacity a glassblower could do in one breath, and 12 fit neatly into what was then the standard wooden case for transport.
Exactly. So what has prevailed for hundreds of years is actually down to the biology of a glass blower's lung capacity.
Yes,
to say that yet, with care.
And yet it's become this untouchable part of wine.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a case of us all mythologizing, is that a word? Yeah,
okay, correct.
Thank you. Thank you. Caffeine for me. Mythologizing the packaging. So what started as supply chain logic has sort of become cultural law.
Well, and we haven't even begun to touch on the world of pretend culture.
I have no idea where you're going with this. So this could be risky, but please do share with us what all your theories are on pretend culture.
So there was this British historian, his name was Eric Hobsbawm, and he wrote a book called Invented Tradition. And his idea was that we have lots of practices that we pretend are historic, but which are invented very recently to meet modern needs. And he also said, we tend to invent traditions and rituals at a time of social stress.
Okay, can you share some examples with us?
So the town where I live in Germany has a great example of an invented tradition. Okay. This is where they host the Wine Queen competition. Now, this is always presented as this kind of continuous harvest ritual that goes back to ancient times where ancient folklore said you had to crown a vintage queen and so on.
Do you know somebody that used to work for me, and she was German, had to take leave from work to go back home because she was in the running to be the wine queen in her region. And guess what? She got crowned. Oh. She was the queen. But I thought that was a centuries old tradition. So am I wrong there? Is it not?
No, it was invented in 1949 as a marketing exercise.
Okay. So do you think wine has many examples of this then, sort of this invention of tradition? Because that seems a bit arcane.
Well, I think that a lot of what we think of as wine culture is nothing more than an invented tradition. So almost anything, like take the Appellation laws, and terroir. This is a 20th century invention that's meant to stabilise rural economies. But now these are considered the way of preserving ancient places, terroir.
Yeah. So in 50 years, English wine will be full of kind of 1970s folklore practices, and we might have a wicker man at some point.
Any suggestions about who we're going to put into it? No, let's
not
go there. Okay, so while I'm offending listeners, okay, so I also happen to think that natural wine is an invented tradition.
Oh.
So if you read what they say about natural wine, it's always presented as this way of resurrecting old practices. And they often say, making wine the way the grandfather did.
Yes.
But actually, if you look at it, it's a postmodern way of winemaking that relies on modern knowledge about hygiene.
Okay, so I think you'd better stop there before someone puts us in a wicker basket.
But I also think natural wine is an example of wine innovation. I'll just get that out really quickly.
Oh, okay, you said that really fast. That's a really controversial statement if ever I heard one. Defend yourself.
Well, it's an entirely new category and it's based on a completely different style of winemaking. But they justify this by saying they're just bringing back the true, authentic past, which is what's critical in wine.
Okay. So I should add then that the idea of heritage and history is sort of constantly reinforced by something else. So authority, we should talk about that. So winemakers, critics, sommeliers, basically the gatekeepers who decide what's good for us being consumers.
Yes. So most consumers, and in fact, even still many people in wine still assume the experts know best.
Yeah, which kind of loops us right back to Bourdieu and the people who hold the symbolic capital. So those rules, rituals, hierarchies, inherited beliefs are sort of exactly what keeps innovation out, effectively.
Well, I think what they do is they keep the appearance of innovation out.
Okay.
There's plenty of innovation happening. It's just they hide that. Okay, so Lily, after all this talk of innovation theory, diffusion curves, creative destruction, which innovations in wine, if you recognise that there are any, do you admire the most?
I do believe there are some innovations in wine, Felicity, and that is a very good question. But before I name one, I should say I have a very strict criteria for calling something a real innovation. My criteria are pretty unforgiving. So this is the premise of my defense of Patrick's question, which we were just sort of started with, which is that wine isn't very innovative. So for a wine to be innovative, it has to do four things. One, it has to redefine consumer behavior, not just extend the shelf. Two, it needs to shift value perception, so build mental availability, not just sort of polish the label. Three, it should widen category participation, so bring in new users, new occasions. And fourth, and crucially, it has to build brand and margin, not just another skew to the clutter. So for me, true innovation really equals behavioral change.
I used to think that I was quite innovative until I heard that definition, and now I realise I don't even pass muster as traditional. Okay, so is there anything out there that meets your criteria?
There is.
You were joking. Is there?
No, there is.
God.
And it's one that quietly ticks all of those boxes, and is something that sounds almost boring, but is genuinely innovative. Ready?
Yep.
Can liners.
Oh, okay. So I think that's a great choice.
Thank you.
I think it's these quiet, unremarked technological changes that have changed the face of wine.
Yeah, because without the new generation of inert specialist can liners for wine, wine couldn't exist in cans before that. So for years, the industry couldn't crack the chemistry. And, you know, we have all the contact issues between the wine and the aluminium and the sulfur reactions, et cetera, et cetera. So the canned wine always tasted, well, you know, rotten eggs as soon as you open the can. So now the new polymer liners have solved that. And they allow for wine to be stored without chemical reactions for up to a year or more, which opens up an entire new format, occasionally. Set everything we were talking about, expanding the market, new users, new category entry points. So think picnics, beaches, festivals, and trains.
Yeah,
so name but a few.
It's not the can that's the innovation. It's the thing that makes the can a viable choice that's the innovation.
Yeah, exactly. So sort of the enabler innovation. So it doesn't just make wine portable. It changes how and where people can drink it. It makes wine relevant to moments where wine had not previously belonged. So it's changed our behaviour. So by my reckoning and definition, therefore, that's an innovation. And Felicity, I have primary evidence to bring to the courtroom to support this. So
I did
what any responsible
You would make a formidable lawyer, Luli. Oh,
thank you. I'll take that as a compliment. So I did what any reasonable researcher would do. I bought some cans of wine and wine-based RTDs and invited my goddaughters over to taste them, all in the name of science, of course.
God, you have so many Gen Zs on tap. It's amazing. You can do all of these proper control trials. I'm envious.
I can, exactly. So the samples came from M&S Foods. So for our non-UK listeners, that's Marks & Spencer, so our national institution over here, sort of slightly posh, dangerously good ready meals and one of the UK's most premium own-label drinks ranges. So it's led by the fantastic Caroline Thompson-Hill, who has quietly made M&S one of the few retailers that consistently experiments with drinks innovation. Well, she didn't. It had the history. She continues it. Proof that sometimes supermarkets are braver than the wineries themselves.
And of course, you just simply had to take some home and turn your kitchen into your laboratory with your Gen Zs on tap.
Yes.
It's a very middle-class experiment, if I may say so.
Well, thank you. So precisely, my goddaughter, so mid to late 20s, sharp, unfiltered, as you say, ideal Gen Z correspondents, and their verdict, cans are a clear category entry point for them.
They did not say that. Gen Zs didn't say, hey, Luli, we think this is a clear category entry point.
No, I'm analysing the data, Felicity.
Okay.
So they said it was perfect for parks, for trains, for festivals, for on the go, the interpretation of which is it's bringing in new category entry points. But interestingly, for at home, they said, never. They would not buy cans of wine or cans of wine RTDs to drink at home. That's when they mix their own because it's cheaper, fresher, and more than effectively.
Can I run a theory I've got past you about why cans are so popular? So I think it's partly or wholly to do because you can control exactly how much you drink. So nobody's topping up your glass. You don't drink more than you want to, and nobody is spiking your drink.
Yeah, which absolutely agree with you, which sadly for the ladies, my goddaughters of Gen Z in their 20s is sadly really important, particularly the spiking bit. So it lines up perfectly with the timeout sip happen study that I was interviewed.
And
it was a really good study.
I downloaded it.
Yeah, exactly. I know that I was interviewed for, and which found that 80. So it was based on UK millennials and Gen Z drinkers, particularly in the on-trade, so when drinking out, which found that 86% of Gen Zs, this is UK, still drink alcohol, but drink differently. So primarily it's around fewer drinks, stronger serves, and a clear split between mindful moderation and maximum impact. So from my very scientific primary research, Felicity, the standout from our tasting was the limoncello spritz. So wine and limoncello sparkling cocktail, 6% ABV, made in Belgium, interestingly, light, bright and dangerously drinkable.
Okay, piece of trivia. Did you know that that is an Australian innovation?
Are you just claiming that because you're Australian or do you have evidence?
No, I'm in the middle of writing an article about it.
Oh, of course you are. Go on then.
The limoncello spritz is actually an Italian drink in the model of the Hugo or the Aperol spritz, but nobody had made it into a commercial drink.
So how come it's everywhere then?
Well, it's because an Australian called Rod McAuliffe from Zonzo Estate in the Yarra Valley was making limoncello during the pandemic. He was there scraping off the citrusy peel. And he suddenly decided to combine it with Prosecco, which sounds easy, right?
Pretty easy. So I take it from your comments, something went wrong.
Well, no, it actually came up with a fantastic drink, but he came up with this really big problem when he tried to commercialize it, which is that if you combine a spirit and a wine, you're tripping into two separate tax classes.
Okay, which goes to show that it's the hidden forces that always make the biggest changes. So how did he go about resolving this then?
Well, he had to spend ages and ages and ages on the bench trying to get the balance right in order to stay within the wine category. And then when he did it, the Australian Taxation Office decided they weren't going to let that fly, and they created a whole tax class just for his spritz.
Okay, so did they call it something really cool and kind of evocative?
No, they did not. No, there is now a tax class in Australia called vegetable wine. The limoncello spritz is a vegetable wine. So the final one, it's called Zoncello, and it's been a massive, massive bestseller that spawned all these imitators. But here's the kicker. Most of the imitator products out there are mostly just wine and flavouring, not wine and limoncello, because of this problem, and also because adding flavouring is just easier and cheaper.
Okay, it's these kinds of innovations that drive the wine industry forward. So M&S with its Belgian-made limoncello spritz might be doing, we could say, or hypothesise, more to modernise wine than kind of half of the global wine production.
Well, this is where we come to a serious problem with these products, which is the legal definition and the tax definition, of course. Mm. You can't legally call these types of products wine because wine is defined very narrowly in law.
Yeah, which we did come up, or we talked about this in our episode when we were talking about colour and we were talking about the blue wine and the issues because blue wine doesn't meet legal definition of wine. But I think that's a bit of a trade red herring, actually.
I'll go on.
Okay, so on the can of limoncello spritz that we tried, it was called a sparkling cocktail and it said very clearly made with sparkling white wine and limoncello. So I don't think it matters to consumers what's going on behind the scenes. From a consumer point of view, it's pretty clear from the product codes, from the packaging, what the product is.
Well, I mean, just to be ornery, I would argue this is taking wine into a crossover category, which is clearly innovative. But wine innovation itself, fitting inside the legal definition of what we understand to be wine, is always going to come from these unseen and unremarked innovations, which can be very dramatic. But at the front, on the shelf, they'll keep the liquid looking pretty much the same as it always did.
Okay. Yeah. So I talked about what I thought my biggest sort of wine innovation can liners was. What's your top pick for wine innovation?
In the last 30 years, I think hands down, the biggest one is temperature control logistics. If we didn't have that, none of us would be drinking New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc or all these gorgeous and innovatively shaped bottles of rosé.
Okay, yeah, I buy that one. I'll accept your temperature-controlled logistics and shipping. So I've already mentioned the can liner, which was my pick for the biggest innovation. So we've presented our evidence, Felicity, both for and against innovation in wine. What do you think the verdict is?
Well, I'm going to maintain that wine is highly innovative, but it hides it. It goes out of its way to hide it.
Okay, unlike you, Felicity, normally, that's a very diplomatic answer. So personally,
I'm not being diplomatic. I think that's a category thing that it does. Oh, okay. It innovates and then it pretends it hasn't.
Okay, fair. So personally, So personally, I'd say wine has been sort of caught loitering with intent. So occasionally brilliant innovation disguised as tradition.
Yes, for all of the reasons we've discussed.
Yeah, exactly. And wine doesn't like to be seen to be changing. It prefers to sort of evolve quietly over the cover of heritage.
Yeah, and this is the problem. When you hide the changes, people assume, of course, that there aren't any.
Yeah, of course. And yet that invisibility sort of is also its charm. So wine's value comes from its continuity. So if we sort of break the spell, it's stops feeling like wine.
Yeah, so maybe the challenge isn't to make wine more innovative. It's to be less scared to tell the truth about it.
Okay, perfectly put. So innovation that respects ritual, but still moves the category forward. So any shifts in your views today, Felicity, listening to
look,
both
maybe,
sides of the evidence?
Maybe you do have a point, a teeny tiny point you need to see with a microscope, but maybe innovation does need behaviour change. But the industry's allergic to anything, so.
Okay. Well, yeah. Thank you for that. And maybe I should admit, a teeny tiny, that innovation can be there, but can be invisible.
So what we would love at this point is we would love to get feedback from listeners on this one. Do you agree or disagree? And have you seen any innovations that we should talk about?
Yeah. So send your comments, as always, to aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com. We'd love to see your feedback.
And we will see you next time on A Question of Drinks, where we will probably open another case, metaphorical or otherwise.
Can't we just open a case of wine, Felicity?
Yeah, if your Bordeaux client sends one, of course we can.
Okay. Won't be Chardonnay, though. You've been listening to A Question of Drinks, the podcast that explores why we drink what we do.
And we're here to answer your questions. If you want to know more about anything drinks, from the marketing history to the economic underpinnings to why this drink is popular and not that one, send us an email.
Send us any questions you'd like us to discuss, and quite frankly, the more random and niche, the better, and we'll have a go at answering them. We can be reached on aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com. That's aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com.
And we would hugely appreciate you reviewing and rating this podcast before you go. 5 stars are much appreciated.